and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome to day three of the pirate radio takeover of the Stephanie Miller Show, featuring Jackie Schechner on news you can use, Tony on music that will wake you up and get you out of bed and get you to work on time, and Rebecca in charge of the odd phone calls where she has to go, yeah, just hang on, we'll get to you eventually, maniac. It's been a fascinating process. Before we get to it, I want you to think for a moment, because last night was the launch of the Iraq War 10 years ago. Last night at 10:15 p.m. or what have you,
that was the moment.
The salvo, yes, the opening salvo of it. The shock and awe heard around the world actually starting and the beginning of missile command, you know, because ultimately that's what that footage looked like to a lot of people. It's like, you know, neon, it's like ravers playing missile command, and that's what you saw on CNN those nights. And there was something that was supposed to be like almost patriotic, uplifting, and positive about, oh, look at this, we're seeing battle. And that was the intention. Now, 10 years later, all of us who said, A, the story leading up to this sounds like crap. There are people coming out in droves saying there are no WMDs, there never were any WMDs that were of any concern to the United States that weren't sold to them by us, you know, in the form of Donald Rumsfeld's ties to pharmaceutical companies that make those kind of things. I mean, there are many progressives who 10 years after are watching the rest of people catch up.
Finally coming around.
Yeah. And then you're seeing these little weird YouTube videos, these 10th year anniversaries with Paul Wolfowitz and other people trying to rewrite the lead up and how important it was. And if you'll watch, every time they do it, they conflate the first Gulf War with this one as if they happened weeks after each other. You know what I mean? Like he was on the border of Kuwait and he had used you know, chemical weapons against his own people, and, you know, we knew that he was a serious threat. But
I'm okay smushing the two together if you want to take the second one as George W. Bush's personal redemption for his father's first war.
Well, that's like, what the
that's
attempt.
Okay for me if you want to smush them together in that way.
Sure, no question. But the idea that somehow there was an imminent threat because of stuff he did in the 80s or stuff we told him he was allowed to do in the 90s, because that was really the factor of, you know, the first Gulf War was that tacit approval from the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, saying, if you go into Kuwait, we won't kick.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing full well we would, and we needed to, so we give them, you know, start moving your troops towards the border, we'll just totally hang back, and then using it as a, you know, as a reason.
Well, I think anyone who was paying attention also thought we're not going into the right country here.
Well, that,
I mean,
yeah,
that
on,
like
that on top of it.
Abundantly clear.
Right. Yes, absolutely. But the way they did it was by conflating all these things as if they were imminent and part of, you know, a consistent threat
right.
to us, even though it set precedent. Regardless, the point I would like to make is that we have a special guest to start the show off today to talk about healthcare specifically, because once you get over all your mistakes as a country and where you have been wasting your money and why, the better thing I think to focus on and to actually get around to is helping your own citizenry and adding pluses to your country instead of padding minuses from others. Call it nation building here at home. Call it, you know, let's actually just get to it. Wendell Potter is joining us right now. Wendell, are you with us, sir? Is he with us? Do I have him? Oh, there he is. He's in. Nope. Do we have him? He's holding. He's locked in. We'll find him.
And we're walking.
I'm not hearing him. It's okay.
We're walking.
We'll get it checked through. Tony is running around. He's trapped in his headphones. He's getting Wendell. Wendell's on hold. We'll get to him. Okay. Why don't you give us a preview of
what we're talking about
yeah,
here? Okay.
He's on 10. Yeah.
So Wendell Potter, who may or may not be with us momentarily, is a former public relations executive with a health insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And Wendell basically had a come to Jesus moment. He had a stroke of consciousness where he said, I can't do this anymore. I can't spin for the insurance industry anymore. The work I'm doing is killing people. And during the fight for health care reform, he decided to speak out and has been doing so since, not only about what the insurance industry has been doing all along to make money on the backs of people who need health care, but also the work that they're doing now to try to sway public opinion as we implement health care reform.
Right. And we have Wendell now, actually. Yeah. Wendell, are you with us?
I'm here.
Good
Fantastic.
Morning.
Thank you
Good
for morning. Joining us.
My pleasure.
So as Jackie was giving your background and where you started in this, what was the, you know, perhaps in context, was there a last straw or was it a build up where you just couldn't do it anymore in the abstract? Was there a moment of emotional crisis where you recognized the ramifications of what you had been doing and what brought you to this moment? Like years ago, if you can recall?
Yeah, there absolutely was. In fact, it was a combination of both. I was becoming increasingly uncomfortable serving as a spokesman for an industry that I knew. I was, you know, seeing more and more evidence in my executive position of the links that insurance companies go to earn profits, and some of their practices were actually causing more and more people to be uninsured. But I guess what really led me to this crisis of conscience that Jackie mentioned was attending a health care fair or an expedition, as it was being called here, where I lived in Tennessee. And I went there out of curiosity, and I saw something I would just never have expected to have seen in the United States. I saw people I could have grown up with. They could have been my relatives. They were standing in long, long lines in the rain waiting to get care that was being provided by doctors who were volunteering their time, and they were treating people in barns at animal stalls. And just witnessing that scene was jolting for me, and it led to that crisis of conscience and a decision that that I ultimately made to leave my job and ultimately to begin becoming a healthcare reform advocate.
Great.
Well, one of the things, Wendell, I mean, you and I got to know each other during the fight, and one of the things that has been a little bit frustrating for me is that we got an open door, but we didn't get the bonanza on the other side that we were hoping for in terms
right.
of the strong cost controls or some of the insurance regulations we were hoping for. How do you feel about what we did and about what's coming? Do you feel like we're on the right track?
I definitely feel we're on the right track. And I was obviously as frustrated as you were, Jackie, and Jackie and I. I spent a lot of time together during those years of reform debate. But I wasn't surprised that we wound up with what we wound up with, which I think was important. It was the most meaningful reform we've gotten in many years. But I was all too familiar with what the insurance industry and other special interests do to influence legislation, first by influencing public opinion. I was a part of that for many years, so as disappointing as it was that we didn't get a better bill, a bill with even we didn't bring every one of us into coverage and would have more cost controls, I'm just all too much aware of just the strength of those well-funded special interests and how they essentially own a lot of lawmakers.
Well, we're at an especial disadvantage with healthcare industry in the same way that when we go up against big oil, for example. There is a resource they are tapping that is you cannot limit. Right now, we have no other fuel source to get our trucks moving and our planes in the air and all the things the blood flowing of our economy without oil in its form. We do not have the technology to move past that, and therefore we are at the whim of big oil on a regular basis. The insurance companies and the current medical establishment has a constant resource of funds in the form of an aging population and a consistent, in sometimes, you know, you can even create a disease where there is none as far as a label goes and start treating it, whether or not it needs that kind of treating. But they have a constant flow of money. There is no way to tamp down And that's part of, I guess, the PR push of this, is that necessary care is used as a way, as a hammer against anybody who would want to limit their growth as far as a profit-making industry. It makes it semi-insurmountable, especially as the baby boomer generation ages. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I would love to hear where you think the next steps can come from. Because obviously, this was the healthcare as we have it, a lot of people, you know, said all or nothing. If I can't get a single payer, I don't want it at all. But the protections against pre-existing conditions and other things like that, I don't think as a progressive I would have given up in exchange for that. But can we get where we want to go? Are these sound rungs on the ladder? And if not, which way do we need to go? So think about that for a second. We'll be back after the break if you can hang with us.
Sure.
That'd be great. Thanks. Wendell Potter with us, former PR executive for the health insurance industry, who realized what he was selling. We'll be back right after this with more of the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in with Jackie Schechner and Tony running back and forth and back and forth trying to make the phones work. It's great. We'll be back.
It's not radio. It's Stephanie Miller.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. Still with us is Wendell Potter. Wendell, we were discussing before the break the kind of impetus that led, I think, yourself, but a lot of people to really realize what the crisis in medical care in this country is. On the insurance front, it was the idea that you could deny people coverage simply because they had been sick before, even if that sickness had nothing to do with the sickness they got. I mean, the stories of, you know, women being denied treatment for breast cancer because they'd had a yeast infection, which was, or pregnancy being a pre-existing condition. There was was shocking to a lot of people, but didn't move the needle. They were just like, well, that's horrible. I can't believe that happens. And by the time it happens to them, it's sort of too late. The question is with Jackie wants to address some of the, I guess, the background or like what you're hearing today about the healthcare law, from misinformation about it to, you know, issues that we still need to move on. And then I think where we can go, what's the next big step we could probably pull? But Jackie, go ahead.
I get a lot of questions via Twitter and other avenues, email. People want to know the validity of some of the propaganda that's being pushed out now. Are you seeing as much of it as I am? And what do you think is going on from your perspective behind the scenes to push out some of this misinformation in the run-up to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act?
I'm seeing it every day, and it's very, very real. In fact, I testified before Congress on Friday. And the reason I was called to testify was because of some of this propaganda that's going on. The House Commerce and Energy Subcommittee on Health was having a hearing, and the title of the hearing was Unaffordable, the Effect of Obamacare on Americans' Insurance. And that's just an example of what's going on, that there's this perception that's being created that everybody's premiums will go up as a consequence of the Affordable Care Act once fully implemented on January the 1st of next year. That's not true, but it's what the insurance industry wants us to believe. They can achieve some cost increases because regulators don't have the authority in every state to limit the amount of premium increases. That's just one thing. But the objective here, the insurance industry had to live with the passage of the Affordable Care Act. They don't like a lot of it. So what they've been trying to do since the law was passed is to try to gut the consumer protections in the law. And they're doing this by making us think that things are going to cost, insurance will cost us more, that choices will be taken away from us, and that taxes will go higher, and even beyond that, that these new regulations will cost jobs. It's all part of a very orchestrated, well-funded scare campaign.
Well, when you Google repeal Obamacare, for example, the paid sponsors that come up at the top, the first one is the Heritage Foundation. Heritage Foundation's petition to repeal Obamacare. The, interestingly enough, I think it's the Washington Post just did this. This is the most recent one. This is March 9th. Lots of Americans still want to repeal Obamacare. That's the title of the story. Lots of Americans still want to repeal Obamacare. Okay.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's hilarious. And the chart they have, and it's 35%. This is the lots.
Okay.
How many self-identified Republicans do you think there are in this country? Somewhere between 32 and 35% of the electorate. That's it. And that has not changed for all practical purposes. The only difference that has come in many ways is people who now identify them because of the Iraq War, or actually identify themselves as independents, even though they vote with Republicans every time. They voted for Bush twice. They voted against Obama because of things like this. Obamacare, they still identify them. So you're going to find, go across the board, women's rights, choice legislation, Obamacare, all these things, your number's going to be about 32 to 36%. That's the number. And that is exactly the number of people who want to repeal Obamacare. And I guarantee that movement, that group of people has not changed in this time. Like, it's not a new group of people who've suddenly come across. There's an interesting part of it, though, and this is what I would like to address with you. 21% want to change Obamacare. Now, the prevailing wisdom in the media, and this is certainly part of the strategy, is that change means they don't like it because they don't like what it does that's new. I think that change number has a wedge of independents who lean Republican who want to change it to limit what it can do. But I also think there's a big chunk of Democrats and progressives and
who
people
want it to do more.
Who want it to do more, who wish it had had a single payer, and so they will not say, I support it. They'll just say, I think we should change it. And the change is actually to make it more aggressive. Yeah, do you find that true?
Oh, absolutely right. I think that the people who want to change it are the ones who recognize that it falls short, that we can do much better than that, mm-hmm. but we just couldn't get it done in 2009 and 2010. Yeah, obviously there are some people who look at the Affordable Care Act and don't like the requirement that we have to buy coverage. And I don't think you don't like it either because we don't have a public option, but mm-hmm. it is what's in the law. I am confident that most of the people who want to change the law are those who say, well, let's build on this. Let's see what we can do in future years to make this much more better, to get us to actually have universal coverage in this country and to have some real means of controlling health care costs, like single payer, for example, which never was given serious consideration by Congress.
Hey, Wendell, I saw a documentary on CNN about 10 days ago, and you were part of that, the Escape Fire documentary, which I feel is about 4 years too late. It would have been nice had that run during the fight. But in the special afterwards, Dr. Sanjay Gupta asked a representative from the insurance industry how they justify making money off of people suffering. And the guy literally said, let's not get distracted by who's making money on what, and then went on. And Dr. Gupta did not respond or press that. Why do you think the media is so remiss?
You mean Dr. Swine Flu Gupta?
Why is it the media is so remiss to lay blame on the insurance industry? Why is it that people are afraid to lay blame where it is? Why are people so afraid to say this is the insurance industry's fault?
You know, Jenny, that has been the most baffling thing to me. Although I say that, I guess I'm not surprised. As you all know, I was a PR guy for the insurance industry for a long time. And over the course of that time, toward the end of my career, I saw the news media being less and less effective, less and less aggressive and probing in terms of asking me tough questions. It's almost like they are AWOL from their job.
Right.
It's amazing. They just don't have the guts or the knowledge to ask the tough questions that must be asked. And I saw that. I couldn't believe that Roger Gupta was doing that.
We're up against the break. Thank you, Wendell Potter, for joining us. This is obviously going to be a continuing fight. Thanks for being here. We'll be back right after this with your favorite Iraq War lies. Call in 1-800-STEP-12. Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation, and only Tony would have the foresight to play War Pigs as we're coming back to talk about. And I want you
guys.
Didn't
I come in this morning and say we should play more War Pigs?
Yeah, but you thought that was a band and you were just trying to fit in. You didn't mean it.
I'm always trying to be cool.
Do you know
than
War
I
Pigs?
No,
by?
Of course not.
It's Sabbath's biggest
anti-war. Do I look like I know War Pigs?
Anti-war, yeah.
Actually, it debuted in the U.S. here on an anti-war label.
Right.
This song, before it was on Paranoid.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons why Ozzy got pushed to the side, you know, as satanic and all that stuff by the establishment was not necessarily because of anything in the music that pointed that, although Tony Iommi liked to play with that imagery. He actually had a cross
and
on
Deezer,
all...
Yeah.
Well, Tony had crosses on his guitars. Ozzy, if you look at Revelation, Mother Earth, and all these songs. There's a lot of religion in Ozzy's songs, and it's very deferential and positive.
Actually, it really is. Was it Symphony? Yeah, all the songs. Yeah.
Yeah, they always, and especially in this regard, you know, this is Satan, like Satan's laughing spreads his wings. The line in that is talking about when the guys like Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. and you know, when these guys die, that's who's there to welcome them for what they've done. I mean, this is a great song.
Good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great song.
And that's what I want to get to today. Because last night, 10 years ago, when we all went to bed, there were thousands of munitions being fired at a city full of civilians. They were run by an evil dictator, we were told, who must be stopped because national security and the security of the world, and that this guy, if he, you know, he has weapons of mass destruction, we know where they are, all these kind of things. I want to know from you what your favorite Iraq war lie was, and who was the person who brought it to you, because there were some good old-fashioned Bush ones, you know, the mushroom cloud, you know, we do not want your mushroom soup to become a mushroom cloud. You'll be sitting at home just enjoying soup. And and in a matter of hours, technology that takes years to actually get to, that they're not actually pursuing, could magically appear in the hands of a dictator and blow you to pieces while you're reaching for Cheetos. We cannot allow that to happen.
Do you think people were paying attention as much as they should have been?
Well, no. The fog of 9/11 gave them a lot of latitude. In all honesty, and there were a lot of Democrats who fell in under that. I think there was a big swath of human beings across the spectrum who I won't use the pejorative I use for them on the air because I don't think I can. But there was a pop of chicken feathers and cowardice that scared them into being right wing for a time. And there are certain people who you're like, what happened to that guy? He used to be kind of reasonable and, you know, or just kind of fun loving and kind of in the middle of things. The Dennis Millers and the quite frankly, the cast of Fox and Friends, who used to be the morning show on Fox that used to talk about, now, what do you do with all that turkey after Thanksgiving? What do you do? We have our special guest on today who says you can make your own jerky with a magnifying glass and some salt. That was what Fox and Friends was pre 9/11.
Right.
They really were. That's what they were competing with Good Morning America and all these. It was not a hard hitting news show. Not that it is now.
Do
but
you have
was,
that recipe, by the way? Because that would be delicious.
Would it really?
No.
I call it ant jerky. You do the same process you did with ants as a child and slugs. Ants and slugs, magnifying glass and salt, and you just burn the turkey like that. You can leave it in the sandwich. Do the bread. Freeze dry the whole thing. This is before this device was available. This is what Fox and Friends was pre 9/11. And then 9/11 happened, blocks from where these idiots live. And I've met these folks. I had clips. I was hosting Talk Soup before 9/11, and I was shooting Queer as Folk when it happened.
Okay.
But I was on Talk Soup. We had clips from Fox and Friends. They were apolitical clips. These were just guests of the ilk I was talking about, and the hosts were that type of host, and they had no special qualifications in any kind of news way. Steve Doocy has no business doing real news, and he knows it. And he knew it at the time. But after 9/11, it was all hands on deck, especially because Fox became, as John Fugelsang says, a mecca for people who hate Mecca. And that was the job for everybody. And so post 9/11, these people, a switch went off in their head. And they went, we could be attacked on our own soil, as if it was a mystery. Now, progressives, I think for a long time, were looking at our support for the Mujahideen and in the Yusuf Saad and all these groups during the Afghan war and going, okay, we're fighting, instead of fighting Russia on our own terms, like a real country-to-country war, we were having a cold war with them and a fake hot war in Afghanistan. Because none of these, everybody goes to, you know, we're getting our asses kicked in, you know, they're getting their asses kicked in Afghanistan, never played into the fact that we were, those Stinger missiles had USA stamped on the side of them, you know, that we were supporting that. And a lot of those arms that are coming back at us today are either reflective weapons coming from the Chinese or the Russians that they had bought after the fact.
Right.
Or stuff left over from when we were there.
Right.
That, by the way, don't work anymore, but was our reason for, in Saddam's case, for going in. So here we are, 9/11 changing this mentality, really bringing, you know, it created this oh crap moment for a lot of people in the media. And then it was a very useful spot for people like the Bush administration who wanted to go in to Iraq. They thought they'd missed the opportunity that H had pulled out too early and hadn't got, you know, it was, you know, whatever, 21, 27 day war. It was, they were supposed to pat themselves on their back about how, you know, they took out this guy and they did all this, but ultimately it ended up being another Grenada for them to some degree in their minds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Project for a New American Century guys famously, you know, putting out that report with the Twin Towers with a bullseye on it. You know,
is that the neocon group?
Yeah, the neocon group who said, this is all we need to do, go back into Iraq is some sort of big Pearl Harbor kind of incident, which is where the 9/11 truthers actually believe they were, you know, part of that. I was one of, you know, there's a video of me out there talking about 9/11 truth in the regard that I don't think we got the whole story, and nobody who has a brain in their head can think that what the Bush administration was saying about the Iraq war or the lead up to 9/11 or the ignorance and action of the Bush administration before 9/11 that we're supposed to take as, you know, them doing their job, and they didn't. The story that they built up was phony. It was phony on so many fronts. Now, you can be a truther without being a conspiracy theorist because you don't have to put I don't go so far as to put the story together.
Well, you could be a truther in that we haven't gotten the whole truth.
Exactly. And I think that's where a lot of them are. You know, it's kind of like the UFO community. They feel like, you know, there's one guy in there who goes, no, they're actually from Andromeda, and they've got a message for us that we all need to grow our hair long. And
sometimes you're defined by the extreme. Yeah.
Exactly. The right-wing outcry about their being primary just because they want to be moderate.
And sometimes progressive activists do it too.
Oh, no question. And hence, the healthcare law. I mean, arguably, there were people who were willing to give up the protection of pre-existing conditions and all these other things because we weren't getting single payer.
Yeah.
They were willing to give that up, and I think a lot of progressives were not, and were able to hold their nose and go, we need to do some brick-and-mortar legislation in healthcare now, otherwise nothing will ever change.
Right.
And so, and we've got a lot of calls, by the way, because I want people to tell about and keep it high and tight because we've got some audio to play of those that Rebecca is putting together right now. So when you bring these up, we will probably be able to reference them after the next break. But let's start with people who've been calling in. Let's go to John in Florida. Hey, John.
Hey, guys. Boy, thank you for allowing me to vent. first of all, Wendell Potter is a hero. I had to say that. Mm-hmm. Have him on some more. One more thing about health care. The president of UNH has made over $1 billion in salary and perks in the last decade of United Healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's where a lot of this money's going for. I've just been steaming the last 3 days. My three to four biggest lies about Iraq. Number one, Larry Lindsey, who was the advisor, chief economic advisor to Bush, still appears regularly on CNBC, claimed that the Iraq war would only cost $100 to $200 billion. It's now going to cost $1 trillion to $2 trillion. He was fired. Number two, Rumsfeld.
By the way, $2.2 trillion is the number, that's the soft number.
Yeah,
it will not cost any less than that.
It's just outrageous. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, 19 days and $100 billion.
Rumsfeld is on tape. I saw it last night, and I remembered this. Said, I would, this is a quote, verbatim, I would be shocked if this takes longer than 6 months. It's now 10 years.
Right, the longest war in American history.
How many people, Cheney, Rumsfeld, said, we have direct evidence that Al-Qaeda is involved, that they're going to hand off weapons to Al-Qaeda, 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 Al-Qaeda. How many times did we hear that?
Absolutely. From Dick Cheney himself, who at the time he said it, knew it was absolutely false. We got to take a break. So I want to take a break. And when we come back, there's a lot of other calls, and I want everybody to get a shot in there. But you bring up some great ones, and we're going to have some audio of that afterwards. Thank you, John. We'll take a break. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. Steph is, of course, at a spa being well taken care of so that she'll be fresh and ready when she comes back Monday to do the show. Jim is, I think, lying in a puddle of his own sick in a Motel 6 doing voices, drunk dial voices to people. But in deference to him, that's how he makes his living outside of the show. And then, of course, Chris is lifting weights. And hiking with his shirt off, if Instagram is any indication. We'll be back right after this. More of the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, at Hal Sparks on Twitter. Follow me there or send messages. You got a favorite Iraq lie? Tell me there.
As it turns out, the revolution will not be televised. It's on the radio. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
How I live. It's amazing that I can be here as early as I am to fill in for Steph while she's away. I mean, Jackie just kind of looks beautiful in the morning and can handle this, but I live by the code of the road.
I've just been doing this for a while now, so I've gotten used to it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've gotten the hair and makeup thing down to, like, 8 minutes flat.
Look at that.
Yeah, it's
I have people do it at Lab Rats. You know, we were shooting.
Yeah, yeah.
I was shooting Monday, Tuesday.
You are spoiled.
No. I got into the film industry. I've always been a stand-up, but I got into acting just so I could have a woman with a brush touch my face twice a week.
I wouldn't mind a woman with a brush touching my
face.
It's kind
of nice.
It's nicer than having to do it yourself every day.
I suppose. Here's the thing. Okay, so we're talking about your favorite Iraq lies. And, of course, I'm a big fan of the Hootsuite. That's what I use as my Twitter.
I don't know what I use.
Oh, Hootsuite's great. It works across all your phone and your iPad and the like, and it has the feeds in multiple panels, and you can schedule tweets for the future when you're promoting something. I always forget the last minute. Oh, right, I have a show this weekend, and I should have,
really?
Like a smart person, been doing it for weeks. Hootsuite allows you to do that. I got a lot of tweets about this. What your favorite Iraq war lie is, and of course we're saying favorite in quotes because. This is our way of trying to discuss this without bursting into flames with anger. But Scott Candage on Twitter says, my favorite Iraq war lie was that oil revenues would pay for the war. I knew that was a lie in an instant. Especially since there was no point in the conversation when so America gets the oil revenue. How does that work out? Oh, no, private companies get the leases.
Yes.
I don't know how that works. Then at what point does... that pay for us? How does that ever... that's like the Keystone Pipeline. Like, yeah, energy for America from Canada that gets to the Gulf and goes right out into the world market by private industries. How does that help me again? Oh, right, my tax dollars have to pay for cleanup if it bursts a hole in it and fills an aquifer in the middle of the country where we get most of our water from. That's how it affects the American taxpayer. Another list of dumb ideas. But here's... the other one was... Rug Cerny on Twitter says, my favorite lie is the implicit one that Iraq would be just fine after Saddam was deposed. Let's go to Ike in Charleston. Oh, we got Ike on the line. We love Ike. Hey, Ike, how are you?
Hey, brother Al. Well, I just, as a side, right up front, don't forget you got to deliver that message to Kathleen Madigan.
Oh, indeed. No, I've got it. I made it out of construction paper and chocolate. Believe me, she's going to get it.
And beyond that, my favorite Iraqi lie, you know, the war, it's kind of like Lay's potato chips. I mean, you know, there's so many of them. It's
right.
It's hard to pick one. But, you know, tongue in cheek, it's like I never understood why people were getting so upset about somebody trying to buy cake in Niger.
Right.
You know, I was like, what's the problem? Somebody went to Niger, tried to buy some cake, you know, and then I find out about yellow cake, and I'll say the most despicable thing of the Bush administration and the Republicans in general, besides Terry Schiavo, was what they did to Valerie Plame. If you've got a problem with a man, I'm a Southern man. You got a problem with a man, you don't go after his wife. That's as low as you can get, brother.
Especially, yeah, and I appreciate it. I want to get to everybody, so I like always ready to hear from you. Ike calls in on my Saturday show on WCPT with great regularity, and he's a great voice, not only for, you know, on issues like this, general politics, but we love hearing Ike talk about workers' rights and you know, how the average, like, just construction, manufacturing, all the workers across this country have been systematically screwed, and Ike's a great voice for that. It's always great to have him on. But you know, even Snopes covers, you know, that uranium, you know, yellow cake was found in Iraq. The removal of yellow cake uranium from Iraq in 2008 proved that Saddam Hussein had been trying to restart Iraq's nuclear program. Look on Snopes. Status? False. In big red letters. Let's go to Alan in Chicago, line four. Hey, Alan.
Hey, how you doing?
Spectacular. Fire away.
Awesome. First time caller, and
I don't have a ding for you. I can, you know, I wish I had, you know, like Randy Rhodes has that ding. I can.
Boom. Yeah, big bada boom.
Bada boom.
There you go. That's the best I can do. So what's your favorite Iraq lie?
Well, I couldn't call it my favorite. I think it's one of the most sickening is that,
yes.
One of the justification points for entering the country in the first place was that supposedly there were, Al-Qaeda being supported or harbored in
right.
Iraq, and what's really sickening about that is they use, you know, the attacks of 9/11 to justify going into the country when I'm starting to realize that we were lied to about 9/11.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what I got to before was that this was, regardless of the circumstance of 9/11, the truth was not told on a lot of different fronts. And the worst part of it is that whether you believe the United States government or members of the United States government were complicit or actually were active in 9/11, the truth was there is no debate at all that they used it for a false pretense to enter the Iraq war and to, you know, and to exercise, you know, the military action in the Middle East on a scale that they never had the right to do or the justification to do. There's the interesting thing is it's almost like people get so caught up in the conspiracy aspect of 9/11 itself that they forget that there was an actual and not beyond debate mechanic of conspiracy to use 9/11 as a precursor to go into Iraq when they knew they had nothing to do with 9/11. There was no ties from Al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein or Iraq. They weren't there. They had not been there. As a matter of fact, it was quite the opposite. It was one of the areas because of his secular rule that they did not have ground. It was the presence of Al-Qaeda was not going to happen. That was actually one of the groups he would have used chemical weapons against. How do you like that? That's amazing. So thanks for the call, Alan. We're up against regular. I think we have time for one more call on this. Let's go to Jay in Missouri. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Al.
What's your favorite, in air quotes, Iraq lie?
Well, you have a perfect segue. I don't believe that there was no debate is a true statement. The debate started, people like Tom Daschle were starting the debate, but then this anthrax stuff pulled out, came out, and started shutting people up. And that's the biggest lie to me, is that
well, that was blackmail. That was that arguably became blackmail. It became this kind of tacit idea that if you didn't toe the line, you might get a package full of dust.
I agree, totally.
Yeah. That's it's an excellent one. We got just a minute before the break. And when we come back, we're going to get to a couple more of these because this is obviously worth continuing on this conversation. We'll also discuss a couple of other stories in the news, specifically the right-wing media's response to kind of rewriting the history of Iraq and protecting the architects of it from, I guess, reality, perhaps. We'll be back. I'm Hal Sparks filling in for Stephanie Miller on The Stephanie Miller Show with Jackie Schechner. She'll be back at the top of the hour with news as well. And I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter. You can follow me there, and you can also send us your favorite Iraq lies via Twitter, and we can read them out as well if you don't have time to call in. 1-800-STEP-12 is the number if you can. We'll be back.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
I got to say that when you're dealing with the lies that led us into the Iraq War, that song has a particular piece of irony that makes it feel like it should be in a hyper-violent scene in a movie about the Iraq War done by Tarantino.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
guns just go, wakaka, wakaka, wakaka. I'm walking on sunshine. Like, you know what I mean? It just reeks of that, considering what, the seriousness of the topic. And we're trying to stabilize emotionally on this and really deal with this, because I think there's a level of clarity necessary. And we're talking about what your favorite Iraq lie is. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. And Jackie Schechner's here. And in the news lead up, if you're listening on the radio and you're not watching on Current, you didn't necessarily catch, there's a letter written by a dying Iraq war veteran.
His name is Thomas Young.
Yeah, Thomas Young, who is wrote it to Bush and Cheney, basically instructing them to beg on their knees for the forgiveness of the soldiers that were killed and harmed and maimed in Iraq. When they thought they were going to be shipped to Afghanistan to fight the people who really attacked us on 9/11, this was the bill of goods they were sold when they enlisted, and then they were sent to Iraq, and then they were not allowed to leave at the end of their service.
Yeah, he was wounded pretty early on, and severely wounded, and has been deteriorating for years, and is now at the point where he is ready to end his own life, and mm-hmm. is not going to do so, but he won't prolong it, and has decided to remove sort of the feeding apparatus and things that will prolong his life. It's a very sad and poignant letter in terms of this man. It obviously is going to be mm-hmm. a great loss to all of us. But he does say that he wouldn't be writing this had he been sent to Afghanistan and wounded there, because when he signed up, he was fully prepared to serve his country in that capacity. Mm-hmm. He did not expect to be sent into Iraq to fight a war that he didn't feel was justified, and nobody felt was justified, and knew wasn't justified. And it's a great kind of FU letter to Bush and Cheney, which is how it's been titled on some of these websites.
And you get on Twitter even, I'm getting from Marcus Byrne on Twitter saying, the six-month lie. I was in college, thought I was going to miss the war. Wife and I now have about 69 months combined in deployments between the two of them. Francis 57 is saying, did they ever find the stockpile of weapons grade plutonium? And they wave hello to you, by the way, in the
aww.
Process. This is, and I want to go to Cheryl in St. Paul, Minnesota. We've got a bunch of people on the line. I'll try my best to get to you, but Cheryl, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Go ahead. Your favorite part of the, favorite as a caveat. Yes.
Yes, in the drumbeat up to war, the administration sold the Senate and Congress. They passed legislation giving George W. Bush the authorization to go to war. And their argument to everyone was, we're not really going to go to war. We're just going to use this tool to scare Saddam Hussein.
Right, which it will never ever happen. And by the way, no one would ever ask for that as a, as a genuine publicity tool overall. You don't need it. We have the largest military in the world. You don't have to bluff about it. You don't ever, we have enough nuclear weapons still online to destroy the Earth 15 times.
I mean, we're talking about nuclear deproliferation. Is that the word?
Yes, it is. It is. And
proliferate.
Yes. Thank you for the call, Cheryl, because the reason I wanted to take her call, too, and we've got a bunch on the line. I'll make sure we get to them. And by the way, in the next hour, we have Imani Gandhi, the angry black lady, joining us, and she's going to talk about this and some of the lead up and some of the people who kind of pose as progressive journalists or as libertarian even journalists who really ended up being fronts for the Bush administration in that while seemingly it's almost like the people who are against drone strikes simply because Obama is doing it, not because it's a bad policy. And it's odd when you go, well, would you rather troops be sent in? I'm confused why you don't like the drone strike part of it. And then you dig down, it's because they think we should have boots on the ground. So we're leading up to
this.
But
is it boots on the ground, or is it the fear of collateral damage by...
I think a lot of progressives are really concerned about the collateral damage.
Right.
What I'm saying is there are some people who don't like the Obama administration's use of drone on the right, not because they're worried about collateral damage, because quite frankly, they shoulder brush those ideas. It's because they think we need to be there on foot and own that land. Which brings me to the drumbeat. The reason I wanted to take her call specifically, and it just was lucky that she was kind of in queue as far as how long she'd been online, was that we're hearing the same kind of drumbeat around Syria right now. I think it's Reuters is putting up this thing, and
Senator Graham and McCain.
Yeah.
Shockingly.
Oh, exactly.
Who want to go to war with everybody.
There's been this charge by the Syrian government that the rebels have been deploying chemical weapons in their battle against President Bashar Assad's government forces. And they've been floating this as you know, a false flag-ish kind of thing. Like, our soldiers are getting gassed by the rebels. The rebels are...
I thought it was the other way around.
No. Well, that's... Our concern is that Assad has them and is going to use them. And I think their preemptive PR strike is they're saying the rebels themselves that are supported by the U.S. and others are using chemical weapons on government forces, giving them an excuse. Well, if they're going to use them on us, we can use them on them, that kind of thing.
I think they haven't been able to confirm something near Aleppo yesterday.
Syrian state-run news channel, which broadcast video of people that claim to have been victims of a rebel attack in the contested city of Aleppo. In response, rebel forces said a chemical attack had in fact been launched by the government and released their own video showing victims apparently choking from the fumes. Both sides put the death toll at about 25, but their argument is that doing it. Well, regardless of who's doing it, the drumbeat from the same folks who are all about getting into Iraq because WMD, because they're everywhere.
And McCain wants to bomb Iran.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's been a consistent thing. Iran being the only country in the Middle East, I suppose, if you don't count Saudi Arabia, because they have too much invested in our stock market to wish us any real ill will. Long term, even though the Saudis were the ones who there were Saudis on 9/11, the Iran actually has a military of force. They have an air force, they have a navy that's actually which Iraq, by the way, didn't. North Korea has nuclear weapons, has actual WMD. We didn't attack them.
No.
One of the ways you can tell we're not going to attack a country is that they actually have the weapons we're saying they have. That's consistent. We knew, for example, that Iran has had a sound military, and that North Korea has weapons of mass destruction. They have legitimate nuclear weapons. Whether they can get them to our coast is another thing.
Right. But the question of whether or not they can get them small enough to put on the head of the missile
and get them to a base in South Korea or any of the ships that are around there. Yeah. So and really do some major damage. That's what's actually kept us at bay at North Korea, and that's why. Arguably, if you were someone like Saddam Hussein, you would lie about your having WMDs right up to the day, because everybody around you is fearing those, too, especially Iran. Iran wants to roll in and take Iraq. That's what they had a war over it.
He's got a banana in his trench coat. And he's
pretending it's a gun. That's exactly it. And the chemical weapons he did use during the Iran-Iraq war and against the Kurds, who were siding with the Iranian forces at the time, the reason he used them... he got them from us. He got them from Donald Rumsfeld specifically, who, by the way, in the Where Are They Now file, he went to my high school. Not at the same time, obviously, but Donald Rumsfeld went to my high school. And he was going to be made a distinguished alum at the same time I was being made a distinguished alum, along with James Stern, who created Stomp the musical, and some other mm-hmm. people who, you know, made something of themselves. And Virginia Madsen, for example, who went to our school, who's really terrific. Well, a bunch of us, when we found out that Donald Rumsfeld, they were going to not only make him a distinguished alum, they wanted to put a bust of him. This was during the Iraq War, like the kind of the height of it. They wanted to put a bust of Donald Rumsfeld in the courtyard of New Trier High School. And a bunch of the alums that I had talked to said, if it goes up, it goes down that night. We're all high school seniors again. We're going to get out there with a chainsaw
yeah.
and take this thing down however we can. Or, you know, roll up there with some chains, and drive away with a pickup truck with it dragging behind us. Because there is no way that's going to be the example of our high school, where all these alums, Rock Hudson, these people had come from this school, had done great things just in the arts and entertainment and in science. And we have so many people who come out of school.
Rumsfeld.
And Rumsfeld's going to be the head that's sitting in the middle of this. Are you high? That's the most ridiculous, especially the guy who, and I think, we should actually, we got to take a break. When we come back, there's a ton of calls in here. I want to play some of these. Let's do a little retrospective, shall we?
Okay.
Let's hear from the voice of these people, not just from the people who are calling in.
Can we intermix?
Yeah.
Totally.
We'll call it in there.
We'll make a collage.
Yes, we will. A sonic collage.
A retrospective sonic collage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now with ointment.
Ew. Gel, please. And we actually have a libertarian on the line who actually doesn't mind me.
Oh.
Yeah, which is
there's
amazing.
A rarity.
Yeah. You know what that means, though? He's a real libertarian and not the Rand Paul kind of libertarian that is really a Republican pretending to be a libertarian so they can get the youth vote. Yeah. We'll be back right after this. More of the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. That's Jackie Schechner, if you're watching Current over there. And we're lucky enough to have her in studio with us.
I'm lucky enough to be here.
Oh, there's no luck involved. It was, quite frankly, activity. it's a choice. We'll be back right after this.
I begged.
Coming up after this commercial, I will be talking even louder.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Gotta love you some Jorgensen in the morning. Ministry.
Clearly off of my iPod.
Absolutely.
Can I say his best albums are always when a Bush is in office?
Yeah, absolutely. Because he gets his best quotes from that.
Yes.
I mean, you know, New World Order. Oh, absolutely. Jesus Rear Built My Hot
Rod. Those albums.
Yeah.
They're great.
Oh, my gosh.
As long as the Bush is in office, he does good.
Yeah. And I think Ministry is right in line with all the other, you know, the tradition of Chicago musicians, from the great blues artists to Styx, Richard Marx, Enough's Enough, and Ministry. Smashing Pumpkins. Like, it's such a, like, it makes, it's so interesting that, you know, these kings of industrial came from Chicago as a, you know, as a music source. It's kind of amazing. So, all right, let's play a couple of these clips, and then we're going to get back to your calls. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number, and we want to hear from you. What's your favorite, and I do this in quotes, and I'm being completely sarcastic about this, your favorite Iraq lie? The lies that led us up. By the way, they're not mistakes. Don't watch those Paul Wolfowitz videos that they're putting out, you know, talking about Bremer and talking about Rumsfeld. There were mistakes made, but I think we did the right thing with the information we had at the time.
Baloney.
Thank you, Loney. They knew. Okay, let's play... Bush or Iraq and Terror, that one. This one, just if you have any questions, it's Bush, Iraq and Terror.
Terror.
That's how I actually pronounce it. Terror. It's one of the last ones, Tony.
You know, one of the hardest parts of my job is to connect Iraq to the war on terror. I believe it. As I told you, Osama bin Laden believes it, but the American people have got to understand that a defeat in Iraq, in other words, if this government there fails.
That's one of the hardest jobs, pushing the propaganda. American people don't believe it because they're getting too much information. I believe it. Saddam Hussein, why would he say Saddam Hussein believes it? I don't even know what that means. What does that mean? Saddam Hussein believes it. He believes that he has connections to Al-Qaeda. Even he thinks that guy he met in that cafe in Niger when he was trying to buy a slice of cake and uranium showed up at his table.
Use the dial-up internet connection.
Yeah, right. I'm trying to... He apparently got a fax of some uranium. We didn't get our facts straight. And of course, who could forget Mission Accomplished?
Right.
Where's a lovely Bush Mission Accomplished there, Tony. We really should put numbers on these because there are so many of them. We should do a countdown.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah.
Get the Mission Accomplished applause.
Yeah, that's applause for the sign.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
2004, yeah.
So let's give or take 6 years amongst friends,
yeah.
Really.
I mean, well, yeah. a lot happened after that speech in terms of warfare.
Combat ops over.
Yeah, sure. No, they all stayed. Yeah. Then nobody, as a matter of fact, more people went in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Major combat operations have ended. Therefore, we are sending in troops. It is time to send in the real strike force. Now that, and granted, most of these combat troops that we're sending in are not actually combat troops. They are no-bid contract workers. That
private
from a company that Dick Cheney still has a stock in, but it's in a blind trust. He has no idea that the company he used to run is making tons of money from his contracts. He has no idea. He's a blind
trust. What year did he go hunting and shoot his friend?
Yeah, we have that one too. We have the very last clip.
I think that's my favorite memory.
This is yeah. Well, hey, don't pay attention to the Iraq War. Cheney's going hunting. Cheney's victim apologizes. What?
He's going to shoot his friend's face off.
We should have sent Dick over there to Iraq.
Kill some Iraq.
Yeah, and made friends with Saddam. Maybe he'd have shot him.
any day now, Tony.
Yeah. Very last one, the whole list. So you got it.
Scroll.
Can I click them from over here? I know where they are.
Use the down arrow.
Yeah, we should number them. It's okay. I will say, though, that we're still getting any luck? No.
We have calls? Can we
yeah.
Have calls?
Oh, absolutely. Let's.
You got too many buttons.
Yes, I know. It's
a pad.
Absolutely. I got three iPads and a laptop and then this thing going. Let's go to Kevin in Buffalo. Hey, Kevin. You've been hanging on for a bit. Hey, Kevin.
Hey. Hi, Hal. How's it going?
It goes very well. The Iraq War is technically over.
Yes.
but when we go through over these these parts, I think the value of doing this, and I look forward to hearing what your favorite one was. But I think the value of going back over this is so that we take the drumbeat for the next one with a tremendous grain of salt, with a salt lick the size of the moon, and we're a slug. You know, but go ahead. Your favorite one.
Well, we can only hope.
Yeah.
I wanted to say my favorite dish from the smorgasbord of deceit, if you will, is the whole pushing of the WMD idea.
Right.
Because I remember hearing about it, and I remember hearing it hammered all the time. And I kind of felt like, I also remember the UN inspectors over there who kept saying they're not finding anything.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Hans Blix was, yes. He got his patriotism called into question because he couldn't find things that weren't there. Can you imagine you've been told to participate in an Easter egg hunt on July 4th, and if you don't find an egg, you get your ass kicked. These are the rules of the game. It's absurd. I appreciate the call. We've got 1 minute left. Let me get real quick one of the ones in here. Let's go to Matt in Louisiana real quick. We got a minute left before the break.
Hey, Hal, yes, I think the biggest lie is the American people. Mm-hmm. We wanted blood, and we didn't care that Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. And to put the cherry on top, Abu Ghraib happened, and what did we do? We gave Mr. Bush a second term.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Amen. I'm sorry. That's it.
No.
We aren't to blame for this mess.
Well, absolutely. That's the thing about having a representative government, and that's what my song, and I appreciate it, what my song American Psycho on Zero One's album is about how little consequence we feel for that our actions actually do have long-term consequences as for other people. You know, we'll be back right after this. More of the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks with Jackie Schechner, Tony on the board, figuring out the clips. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. Clearly, it is I, Hal Sparks, filling in. Otherwise, they would be playing Flock of Seagulls when we came back from commercial or something.
We do have a vacation update.
Oh, look, we do?
We do. So Roland is on vacation with Stephanie.
Right, which means she's got him in a hamster wheel running 9 hours a day with electric.
Well, people were concerned when I mentioned that she had booked an eight-hour hike.
Mm-hmm.
And Roland said, no, he is not on that hike.
No.
He said instead he has been playing tennis and has been told by the instructor that he grunts like a lesbian.
How does is the instructor a lesbian?
I don't know.
See, I think I would defer to her if she was.
Right. Well, that was what he said, and then he said he also got in trouble.
You know what the response always is?
What?
Which lesbian?
I don't know. Is there a particular lesbian?
Well, I think that's the best response to you throw like a girl.
Which girl?
There's some. You ever watch some, like, fast pitch softball or like, they'll take your head off.
Oh, no, they're much stronger suspect by that.
It's
quote.
Actually my common joke for dealing with accidental sexism, racism, mm-hmm. or homophobia is you say which, da-da-da.
That's not a bad...
It calls them into question without going, oh, so you're saying that all, and then they go, nah, I'm not I can't be sexist, I have a mom. You know, they bail out using that old chestnut.
Well, I think for Roland, the comparison was as opposed to you grunt like a gay man, which...
And so that's okay? So somehow...
No,
so,
but he is, and so I think...
Was the person clapping at the time?
I don't
Were they
know.
Somehow saying, that, like, that's nice, you grunt like a lesbian when you do it, you know?
I have talked myself into a circle, but that came from Roland.
All right.
The second part
Roland,
is...
Roland, you are very weird.
Is he got yelled at for sneaking in a sweet and low...
That, I believe.
...to the spa. The head waiter yelled at him.
A sweet and low? What is it?
A sweet and low, or the sweet... I don't know. He put it in his purse, and along with the rolls
purse.
And the butter. I don't know. But
you
he said
sneak
that,
sweet and low into a spa like a lesbian. I don't
I
understand.
I don't know. But he said that outside carcinogens are not allowed. So he's having a good time.
Uh-huh.
But he's been playing a lot of tennis, and Stephanie's been hiking.
I'm very happy for the two of them. Yeah. All of it sounds crazy to me. Let's take some calls. let's go to Rob in San Francisco. Hey, Rob. How are you?
Good. How's it going? I just wanted to congratulate you yesterday. I don't normally listen to this show. I don't get it live,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a libertarian. But when you were talking about how they were handling the rape case, I wanted to applaud you for calling out the Candy Crowley. And I think if we have more people on both sides of the aisle calling out inappropriate behavior,
mm-hmm.
regardless of their political leanings, I think that's how we can bridge the gap. And I think, for instance, you know, it was stupid of whatever those politicians were that said, oh, a woman's body shuts down during rape.
Right.
That guy should be out of there. And I don't care if he's a Republican or what. He should be completely out of there.
I totally agree. I totally agree with you. And I think regardless of party, if somebody said that, they should lose their seat. The interesting thing is you would be very want to find a Democrat who would say that. You would also be want, I think, to find a genuine libertarian who would say that. I mean, you know, everybody knows I've toured with Doug Stanhope. I've done shows with him. I like him a lot. He ran as the libertarian presidential candidate in, I think, 2008. He's a terrific guy. He's probably the last person you would want in the White House because he makes his living not giving a crap. But he's a true libertarian, a very laissez-faire human being. And, He would never think to limit a woman's right to choose what to do with her own body. That would be primary to the libertarian philosophy he lives by. And yet you have what I think are, you know, Rand and Ron Paul as phony conservatives who are using the libertarian angle to get the youth vote to push them ahead in straw polls at things like CPAC. That's the only reason they do it. Because and a real libertarian, I don't think, would ever come out and go, yeah, if a woman's raped, you know, her uterus will punch the sperm in the face. And she won't get. It's absurd. That's just. You would never say that, Rob. Would you? I think I'm correct in assessing that that would never even occur to you as a legitimate conversational element.
No. Right. I mean that was ridiculous. And yeah. I think unfortunately both political sides, I think, tend to view this as like a football team, and it's like they latch on as a true fan, and no matter what they say through thick and thin, they'll stick by them, and that's not the case.
I do
hold these people accountable.
Right. I do think, you know, in defense of the party that I vote with and that I have affiliation with, I'm a Democrat. I'm comfortable with that idea. I think the libertarians actually, on a legislative level, have more in common with Democrats than they ever have with Republicans, which is why I always find the Rands and the Rons of the world very suspect. But especially when it comes to your right to live your own life and choose those kind of things. And in this case, it is a distinct line. There is no, it's not just because I have a D on my shirt and they have an R on their shirt. There, you don't find any Democrats of in Congress, in the Senate, as a president, anybody ever saying anything even remotely like that. Whereas during the last election cycle, you had multiple Republicans saying it, so much so that they said, we've got to stop saying it. They never said, we have to stop believing it. And that's an important distinction. I think it's okay to make those distinctions if a party is being led that way, because otherwise you let them off the hook. Then Republicans go, well, if it's the same on both sides, they never have to learn the lesson of where they're going. You know what I mean? They never have.
Well,
I
know what you mean, and that's what I'm saying. I think both sides need to start holding their parties responsible for these statements. And, you know, I don't think Candy Crowley can be considered a conservative, and that's why I respect you for calling her out.
Yeah.
That was an inappropriate thing to say.
Right.
And, you know, in terms of being a libertarian, I fully believe that we should have the freedom to choose what we want to do with our lives and with our bodies with as little government intrusion as possible. I view government as a necessary evil to keep order, and I don't want to give it more power than it's already taken. If you look back at the founding fathers, this was not the vision that they had. This was the vision that they left. They didn't want an all-encroaching federal government.
But they also, at the time, they were dealing with the only kind of government that existed in the world was a monarchy. And so it has to be taken slightly in context with that. And they also didn't want the states to be able to divide the union and have singular rule. That was the entire part of, I mean, that's the United States part of America. And that's
exactly,
you know,
that's why we have checks and balances.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So I appreciate the call, Rob. I really do. It's a worthwhile conversation. Let's see. We got a couple minutes left. Let's go to George in L.A. who thinks Obama is just as bad as George Bush. On the war, I suppose.
I did not say that.
Okay, sorry.
I did not say that at all.
Okay.
My question to you, there was a caller that earlier said that it's our country, it's our fault as a nation that after Abu Ghraib, we reelected Bush.
Uh-huh.
Well, after Benghazi, we reelected Obama. So wouldn't that make us just as stupid now as
so
we
you're
were
equating,
then?
Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. So you think Abu Ghraib, the systematic, over time, months, and a strategic point to torture innocent civilians in many cases for information they did not have. Oh, well, hold on. Over years, the creation of Guantanamo Bay and black sites all over the world for shipping off people who we cannot try in open court either because of lack of evidence, coerced evidence, or the fact that they were never guilty of anything in the first place, but the embarrassment would cause us too much, or we believe we've created an enemy, and if we set them loose, they would actually be an enemy now. You think that that's absolutely on the same level as an attack on the ambassadors in Benghazi by a local militia group attached vaguely and softly to Al-Qaeda. No direct ties, no order taken from it. As a matter of fact, the decimation of Iraq and Afghanistan and the leadership has happened more under this president than any other. And certainly when regard to Osama bin Laden, you're saying Benghazi, the single day, the 7-hour period that was Benghazi, is on the same level of the violence of Abu Ghraib. You're saying that. You really believe that.
Now you started throwing words there, but first of all, nobody was murdered in Abu Ghraib, okay?
Nobody was murdered in Abu Ghraib.
Not to my knowledge.
Then that's why we're having this conversation, because you are talking out of your backside. You don't know that people were shot in the head. You don't know that people were froze to death. You don't know that people were left to die. But you think it's the same thing. Why do you think it's the same thing? Why do you think it's the same thing?
An ambassador was murdered. Four Americans were murdered.
Right.
Okay, and it doesn't matter if it was a ragtag.
4,000 American soldiers were killed in Iraq.
It doesn't matter. Sir. It doesn't matter if it's a ragtag militia or if it's me and my friends going over and murdering these people. It wouldn't matter. They got murdered.
Did Obama give the order? Wait a minute. Did Obama give the order to have these people killed? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'll tell you, Ronald Reagan would have not hesitated. That's for sure.
Reagan would have killed the American ambassador in Benghazi.
No. Ronald Reagan would have told you, go and protect our people there. I guarantee you that. I've heard speeches of Ronald Reagan, and they sound completely different as they do to Obama.
Did you? You mean the speeches around Iran-Contra, for example?
And nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect.
I don't think you
can
speculate
Lord.
How President Reagan would react in today's environment. I mean, I think militarily things have changed.
Well,
if policy's
any indication, he'd be a Democrat, because he'd have to change parties after he was primaried as a Republican.
Because he was too moderate compared to where the Tea Party conservatives stand today. Yeah.
The
nature of warfare's changed.
Bless
too.
His heart. Is talking out of his posterior, and he is using Fox Facts to patch the holes in his ignorance. And we could go on back and forth about this, but you could tell with the diversion from Benghazi to Reagan.
A cooling gel might be good for
yes,
that.
It would. I would say to George, before he calls back in and tries on another show or even on this one, to push that as a paired example of presidential egregious behavior, to read up on history. There are plenty of sites out there, both right and left, where you can look at the timeline leading up to the Iraq War. You can look at pictures from Abu Ghraib, and you can look at the backstory of the people who were killed there, and at other sites just like it. Abu Ghraib was not the only one. That was simply the one where the pictures came from. And the ridiculous arc of associating those two things is like saying that the first bombing of the World Trade Center is equal to the second bombing of the World Trade Center and Pearl Harbor. They are all the same thing, and he thinks a bunch of his friends could go over there and just shoot up the bad guys. Oh, George, you live in a cartoon. That's it. All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back right after this with more of your calls. 1-800-STEPH-12. Your favorite Iraq lie. And when I say favorite, I mean in quotes. Jim in Madison has a great one, I think. And there's Scott in Boston. I totally hear you, brother.
Dude,
we'll know what they are
Scott
when we come back.
Boston.
Wait till you'll know what I'm talking about. Oh, yeah.
This is too weird, man.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller Show. That is such a great drum sound. It's one of my favorite things about that album. The drums.
You know who this is?
Yeah. It's escaping me, though. Now you ask me.
The Sword.
Yeah.
Nice.
It drove me crazy for a second. I was like, yes.
Yes, them.
We brought the Sword into the studio when we were picking drum sounds. We were like, listen to that snare. And if you listen to the 01 record, you can hear the pop of that snare.
I'll play something of one of my bands. Yeah. My favorite bands, drum-wise, is Sepultura.
Yep.
Oh, I'll play something later of that.
So, back to our favorite Iraq War Lies. Now, I don't think this caveat is necessary, but it's interesting that somebody brings it up on Twitter. And I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter. You can certainly throw us your favorite Iraq lies there as well if you don't have time to call in or the or reception, as it were. But some people were bringing up, you know, the idea that if you didn't support the Iraq War, you didn't support the troops. And in many progressive circles especially, we were actually baffled by this because one of the reasons you were against... one of the reasons why you didn't... Well, it wasn't a non sequitur. It was actually a counter... It was an information countermeasure. It was to stop your argument before it started, because the real progressive angle on it was, no, we actually support our troops so much we don't want them sent where they don't need to go.
Right, right.
You don't want them put into harm's way. You don't want them endangered. You want, and you don't want their efforts ultimately wasted or used in vain for some sort of errand that you deem politically, you know, part of what you want to have happen, when the reality of what you, their job needs to be, is elsewhere.
I'd love to get a veteran or two to call in if we have.
Yeah, we have a couple.
Because I don't think...
That have been talking to me on Twitter especially, too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were... I don't think there was any part that felt like they were doing the right thing in Iraq. They wanted to be there either, but there is a loyalty to country and a loyalty to their fellow soldiers or fellow Marines, that they have to be there to protect one another, but they weren't particularly supportive
of the mission,
itself. That they were sent
right.
to do.
Well, because it was also very unclear. I mean, what do you... What's the day for, and I would be curious to ask somebody like this, and actually we'll go to JC in Tucson, who served in Iraq.
Hello?
Yeah, hey.
Hi,
JC.
What's going on? Hey, I love you guys' show, by the way. This is pretty good commentary.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm almost baffled sometimes by the nonsensical crap that a lot of U.S. individuals say concerning this war. Like the last caller who's trying to equate the Libya situation to Iraq. Iraq was a completely political, like, scheme that the U.S. was trying to get involved in. You can't, like you said, you can't compare a militia doing something, attacking the embassy, to us invading a country and completely, you know, disenfranchising and destructuring their whole entire military, political structure and everything else, when we could have done it a lot better.
Right.
I've lost three very good friends over an unjustified war, and I'm a current U.S. service member right now, and I'll tell you something. Service members will do what we're told to do, because that's what we're doing. We're right. devices of the U.S. of the United States. So we're going to do what we're told. That doesn't necessarily mean that we always agree with what we're being told. But we, as good soldiers, or good Marines, we're going to do what we're told. And I just wanted to say that unjustified war is a really sad thing, because 5,000 Americans, including three friends that I've known, you know, have made widowers of. You know, of individuals, fathers will grow up, you know, kids will grow up without fathers, all because one person had to, you know, go on national television and create a bunch of sensationalism and hyperbole when we were, you know, already kind of reaming from, you know, the terrorist attacks on September 11th. And most Americans, if you ask them at that time, I came back from Afghanistan on my third tour, right?
Right.
Someone asked me what part of Afghanistan Iraq was in, and I was we've been fighting another war in Afghanistan before we went into Iraq, which we should have finished, because if not, we would have been done so long ago.
Right.
And all our resources could have been put, you know, into one basket instead of trying to be divided in two.
Exactly.
And people forget that for so many different reasons. So I'm glad that you guys are talking about this, because this has had so many echoing effects with the economy, with PTSD, you know, people coming back with so many different, you know, ailments and things like that, trying to find work, trying to get back to justice society, all that. It's completely unnecessary.
Right, the cascading war
that could have been avoided.
Right, the cascading cost of the Iraq War is almost unfathomable. The practical cost being about $2.2 trillion. But you talk about the loss of even just normal life things, just the cost of health care and support for all the veterans coming back, the extension of their families, in the middle of the economic downturn, so many soldiers losing their homes. And having to fight their way back with in situations they should not have found themselves in, which means their money is wasted fighting something they never should have had to fight in the first place at home. that they could have done used to start their own business or educate themselves beyond what the GI Bill did or those kind of things. There's such a drag that it's almost unchartable. Here's what I would like to ask you real quick,
okay.
if you can. I don't know what timeline you were there, but it would seem to
me. I was there. My first tour was 05. I did my first tour 05.
Right.
And then I did another tour in 06 and another tour in 07 before we started wrapping
okay.
up.
Okay. I don't know if what your experience was or perhaps other soldiers, but I'm curious as to what the day after the mission accomplished speech and banner, what it was like to be a soldier on the ground there going, we're not leaving. This
yeah.
isn't over.
I'll give you a really good example of that, and it almost was heartbreaking. When I was stationed there, I was in Sadr City, which at the time when I was there was one of the worst places to be.
Right.
And to be graphic, the day that he gave this game over speech, you know, everything's all good, I literally lost a friend who was pretty much had his head cut off because he was in a turn, and he drove down the street, and the Al-Qaeda was using piano wire, stringing it up to, you know, pretty much decapitate turn drivers.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost one of my best friends that way. So I don't really think the mission was over when he announced that. And I just think it's kind of funny. Another thing that I kind of want to put out, and this is the nail in the coffin, when he said that the Iraq war was over, like I said, we were still in Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan on my first tour while all the money was going to Iraq. And literally,
right.
as a U.S. military, that we're supposed to be one of the biggest militaries in the world, we ran out of ammo. We ran out of water. We ran out of food. Like, while we were doing combat operations
right.
in Afghanistan, because no one concentrated on that war while they should have been doing it in the first place.
Well, we appreciate it, J.C., and thank you for calling
thank
in.
Thank you for
giving
your service,
yeah,
too.
It means
well,
a lot
you
calling in and talking about this. We'll be back after this with more of the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, and that's Jackie Schechter. We'll be back.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. It's hour three of day three. Oh, very exciting. We're in the home stretch of this particular show, but we're just getting our groove, I think. This, episode, if I can call it that, of the Stephanie Miller Show, we've been dedicating to the lies that led us into the Iraq War. And what's your favorite? And the amazing thing is, although our first caller right out of the box listed like three or four,
mm-hmm.
There hasn't been but one overlap. Everybody has a different one.
How sad is that?
Yeah, there's enough to go around, and the lines are lit up. I mean, they're crazy off the chain. Before we get into the show, by the way, this hour of it, coming up in the next break, Imani Gandhi, the angry black lady, is going to be joining us. For those of you that listen to my CPT show, the Hal Sparks radio program, Mega Worldwide, Saturdays from 11 to 1 Central Time in Chicago. Great progressive station, chicagosprogressivetalk.com is their site.
Reminds me of a story. I was renting a U-Haul down in Florida, and
oh,
the woman walked
story.
Me out to the U-Haul. You don't know this story.
No, but
walked me out to the U-Haul, and she smelled really good. And I said, what are you wearing? And she's like, oh, it's a special scent. It's called Sassy Black Woman. And I said, really? And I said, that's really a thing. And she said, yeah, that's really a thing. And I said, huh, do they make neurotic white girls?
Right.
And she said, I don't know. You need
yeah.
to check. But that was, it was like something like that. Like
yeah,
Sassy Black
Calyx.
Queen or Sassy
no.
Black. It was amazing. She smelled lovely.
No.
So, but that was the name
well,
of the fragrance.
Well, I know for a fact that Imani Gandhi, the angry black lady, smells lovely
yeah.
herself.
But did they have a fragrance?
I don't think they should have angry black
angry
lady.
Angry black lady fragrance.
Yeah. Wear it! Wear this! Like, she just, and that's what the ads are. All this slow, cascading video and a wonderful bottle and just this woman screaming. And they have the woman who played Ann Esther on Sanford and Son pushing it.
That's awesome.
Or you could do Iman. It wasn't Iman. Who was the supermodel who was chucking phones?
Naomi Campbell.
Naomi Campbell. They could have Naomi Campbell come out and she would be the spokesperson, frankly. And it was like she'd check her phone at the screen, and it would go right up to the screen, and it would actually be the perfume bottle is a cell phone, and you unscrew the antenna on the top of the old flip phone. That's where the perfume comes.
The brick,
in.
The old brick.
Yeah, right. That would be genius. So we will be getting to more of your favorite Iraq lies in just a second. Shameless plug, this weekend, Sunday night, 7 o'clock Pacific time, I'm doing a stage it show at Flappers here with some of my comic friends. You can go to stageit.com/Hal Sparks, sign up, get ready, watch the show, buy a ticket. It's a live show. It's not, you know, saved on the internet anywhere. It is what it is.
I can't DVR it.
Nope, you got to be there, and that's the cool thing about it. It's like really seeing a live show, and it's I'm trying to help some of my other comic friends really get some legs and get some exposure when they're not going to get it through the normal channels. So if you could help us out, that'd be great. Stageit.com/Hal Sparks. Plus, my band 01 is going to be playing on the on Friday the 29th at Count Vamped in Las Vegas. Or is it the 29th or the 28th? I'm completely hammered. It is the 29th, yeah, at Count Vamped in Las Vegas, and April 4th at the Viper Room in Los Angeles.
Ooh.
So put
what
that,
day of the week is that?
That is it's a Thursday. Yeah.
Did you do a weekend show?
Yeah, I do a weekend show.
The
Vegas one isn't Friday. You could leave
fly
right after work and fly to Vegas
there
and see
go.
Us there. It's a great book. Right. It's us and Saigon Kick.
That's exciting.
Yes, 25th anniversary of The Lizard, the album that they
If I go to Vegas and watch you guys and say, I'm not coming back.
No, yeah, you're going to be there. Monday, they're going to have to send out an APB.
They'll come get me.
That being said, all that info is available at HalSparks.com. You can follow me at HalSparks on Twitter. And, of course, you can watch the Ustream live on the weekends, and you can also join the chat on my Facebook page, Facebook.com/HalSparksFang page, F-A-N-G. Because I have sharp teeth. So, all right. In about 5 minutes, we're going to have Imani Gandhi. Let's take some more calls because I want to. There were a couple people, especially right before we went, and Jim in Madison has a good one. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I don't believe I actually start off saying how you doing when I hate it when everybody else does that.
it's like a tractor beam of social indoctrination. You just can't. Avoid.
I know. Just to bring things a little bit more to our sarcastic point, my favorite Iraq lies came from the Iraqi information minister while the attack was going on.
Yes, Baghdad Bob.
Yeah, this is the guy who sat there saying the Americans are killing themselves outside the city, no one's coming here, and there's two Abram tanks standing behind him across the river.
Well, he had some really good ones, and you can find them kind of listed everywhere. There are no American infidels in Baghdad. Never.
Yeah.
Well, it's like there's no gay people in Iran either.
Right, yeah. He and Ahmadinejad should have started a PR firm. It's called Alternative Reality and stuff, and they could work with Reince Priebus for the rebranding of the GOP, and they could all just pretend things aren't the way they are and write slogans like, that never happened. What do you think?
I love that guy. I think somebody was selling pictures of him on T-shirts and aprons now. So.
No, absolutely. My feeling, as usual, we will slaughter them all. I love the as usual part of that particular quote. As usual. My feelings, as usual, are our initial assessment is that they will all die.
Like, because it's Thursday.
Right. Surrender or be burned in their... this is really like... it makes what's his name, the ventriloquist with the dead terrorist puppet.
Ahmed,
Jeff Dunham.
Yeah, Jeff. Yeah, it makes Jeff
He's
Dunham's
awesome.
Lines sound written. You know what I mean? Like,
he was awesome.
Yeah, he was. Great point. Oops, sorry, I lost you there. Good one for that. And I also want to go to Scott on 5 because we actually have a quote to go with this one. You know, let's get him up here. Here's Scott in Boston, Mass. Hey, Scott.
Hey, good morning. How you two doing this morning?
Good morning.
Great job filling in. Yeah, mine still burns my butt to this day. It was when, I don't remember if it was the run-up to the war or after they had actually been caught in their lie that there was no WMD, but it was Bush in, I believe, the Oval Office looking underneath his desk, underneath chairs, and going, hey, there's no weapons of mass destruction in here.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, as a dad of someone whose son did a tour in Iraq against my best wishes, to have this guy joking and laughing about the fact that he sent 4,000 of our men and women to die,
right,
and the hundreds of thousands who we killed in Iraq, it makes the hair stand up on my back.
And the amazing thing is, this was not one of his regrets. You know, he said he had some regrets, and they were all messaging regrets. They were not policy regrets, which is amazing. But he's like, I probably shouldn't have said bring them on. I probably shouldn't have said dead or alive. I do have regrets. He never brought that up. He never said that was that was inappropriate. I'm a jerk.
He never had any skin in the game. He and the whole clan of them, they just, it was like it was something on TV and make believe, which I think is how a lot of America saw it. And
the skin in the game was financial.
But there was no loss of that.
God,
they were gaining
right.
from it.
So much.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. a win-win, because the whole thing is, if they just carpet bombed Iraq back to nothingness, you could still, Exxon and you know, all these other companies could roll in, if everybody was dead, stick a hose in the ground and pull the oil out.
Right.
I mean, the worst case scenario is that there's nothing left. You could nuke the place and they'd still find a way to slant drill into
the
area.
Mm-hmm.
It was beyond no loss for them. It was amazing. So to channel my best Casey Kasem, Scott in Boston, Mass. This one goes out to you. This is George Bush joking about not finding WMDs.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere.
Hysterical.
Here's the funny thing. No, they don't. Here's the thing. If they'd have found some later, he'd have been forgiven for that joke. They would have passed over it. People have forgotten about it, but every time they hear it, they're like, that's awful.
When I can't come up with a joke, I think, let's go with something war-y.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just not, you're talking about people's lives.
Well, and it was, by the way, it was pictures of him looking under
their
bed and, you know, nope, none in there, in the closets at the White House. Like, it was just like.
Was it the White House Correspondents' Dinner or something like that?
Yeah, he played that at the thing, and it was like, are you, here's the thing, if he'd have just told that, if he'd have looked under the podium, it would have been an inappropriate joke. He'd go, I've been looking all over for them WMDs. None under here. Okay, I'm still looking. It would have been inappropriate and awful on that level. But they stopped their day in the middle of a war
to shoot that video.
Shoot those pictures so that he could make that joke at the Correspondents' Dinner specifically. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a fan of Obama's Predator drones joke. You remember he made that joke mm-hmm. about his daughters and stuff like that? But I also know full well that's a joke that most dads would make. And it's probably one the Joint Chief guys say about their, you know, my daughters, I know the guys in Kansas City who run those things. Like, they'll make a joke amongst themselves. Nobody but George Bush was making I think I got some WMDs under the bed. Like, that was it. It's the only person, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't forgive that joke from Obama, but I bet you it's more common in those circles than that was. That was an active choice to make a joke about one of the, probably, if I got to pick my own, single worst lie about it. When we come back, we're going to have Imani Gandhi joining us. We'll have more of your calls. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. And there's some people that have been holding on for a good long while. I'm going to get to them. I will get to them. Look at that. Where did that feedback come from? There's two of me. It's amazing. We'll be back right after this.
I think sometimes when you switch over, that happens.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, this is so amazing. It's all anybody in my class is talking about.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's so hard to interrupt that song. That's the problem with when I work with Tony, is that he plays music so good.
Thank you.
That I feel like we should just DJ.
I have to thank you for this one. I haven't listened to this album in a long time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to listen to this now when I get home. Or on the way home, I think, actually.
The diatribe about, you know, how much we spend on different stuff and versus law enforcement, and it's amazing in the middle of that song. He has a speaking part. There's a point where he just stops and makes a political point during the music breakdown. He just breaks down the budgetary constraints of law enforcement versus space exploration and other stuff. And
I need like a good rock music boot camp.
Yes, we do. We should do that. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Just kind of let me catch you up.
Yeah. I need. Seriously.
I'll do a Ustream about it in the future. Like, I'll have Tony on as a guest.
Please, yeah.
And we will walk people through the paces, and it will archive it so people can look again. Now, by the way, speaking of people who rock, though, by the way, how do you like that segue? Joining us now is Imani Gandhi, the angry black lady herself.
Hello.
So
good
to have you on.
Good morning. I'm so excited to be here. I even put on my fancy pajama pants.
Well, that's great. Yes.
Do they have feet?
They don't have feet, but they are red and white candy stripes, so
ooh.
It's a little Christmassy up in here.
Mm-hmm. So let's get started on this whole thing. Do you have a favorite Iraq war lie?
It's got to be the mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, you know, I spent last night, Mother Jones has a really good timeline on the run-up to the war.
Right.
And I read it, like, right before I went to bed, which was a bad idea, because I got really angry all over again. I just remember being so angry and watching as we were doing this, thinking, this is so wrong, And, yeah, I mean, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, I guess, you know, because they're, you know, my race homies or whatever.
Right.
I don't know how they live with themselves. I don't know how any of these people live with themselves. It's really, it's just horrifying. And it's amazing to think that it's been 10 years because it doesn't feel like it's been that long.
Right.
And I was just out of law school when that happened. I just moved to L.A. I literally started work at my first law firm, Latham & Watkins in L.A., the day before 9/11, my first day of work as an attorney was on September 10th. I woke up on September 11th, and people were, my friends who I'd made friends during my internship the prior year were calling me, "Don't go to work, don't go to work." And I just remember thinking, "What's going on?" Turned on the TV and saw that, and then I thought, "Well, this can't be good," because I knew that there was going to be something that was going to happen as a result that was going to be just wrong.
Right.
And
this ended up being a big, you know, basically baiting by Osama bin Laden,
right,
that Bush fell for, in the same way that, like, if you...
Do you think he knew that Bush was going to go after Iraq?
Well, the idea was that you had to... You got to bring them out. You can't... The strategically speaking, you have to draw them off their own... Like, attacking us here meant that we were going to bring our troops over there, and they wanted to spend our blood and money in the sand. This was the...
Right, but do you think that Osama bin Laden expected that the administration would go after Iraq and not immediately go into Afghanistan?
No, but I don't think they cared. I think they knew we would do something stupid along with anything smart that we try to do, especially because George Bush was the dude. If they honestly, had Al Gore won or had Bill Clinton still been in office, I don't doubt that they would have tried different terrorist tactics and built a long-standing, you know, that this was a goal for a long time. But I think they really felt like that Bush was the right guy for this strategy to actually work. Because it's just like yelling a homophobic epithet at some guy with a weak sense of self in a bar so that he runs out the door after you and your friends are waiting there
to ambush.
To beat him up. And because you can't fight him because his friends are in the bar. You know, it's that simple. So, and this is an interesting thing, Imani, because the, you know, in this, you have Condoleezza Rice and the PDB, and you have Donald Rumsfeld and the you go to war with the known unknowns you don't know, and
you go to war with the army you have, with the military you have, not the military you want, or whatever that quote was.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just so awful.
With the
so unarmored,
yeah, the unarmored Humvees that you have at the time. The hard part though is, and you wrote an article about, you know, Glenn Greenwald and some of the others who just seemed to take this kind of perma-tack on how they were addressing anybody who didn't. Well, first of all, they were for it before they were against it. And then anybody who was against it from the beginning but then doesn't necessarily play by their rules gets attacked. It's a very strange thing.
Well, the thing that bothers me about him, and I'm actually really glad that I got an opportunity to come on today, because I was really furious yesterday, not because he was calling people out and, you know, calling Chris Matthews repellent and calling MSNBC's coverage of it gross and vulgar, because it was gross and vulgar. I mean, it was, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, Wag the Dog.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Of course.
It was very much like that. And I remember watching it thinking, this is all crap. You
mm-hmm.
know, like, this is just insane.
Right.
Sort of this lust for war and this weird admiration of George Bush. I found it really disgusting. But what I find particularly disgusting about Glenn Greenwald is that he supported the war at mm-hmm. the time. He's been trying to claim that he didn't by saying, well, no, I didn't support it. I was passive and apathetic. And first of all, his frequently told lies document that he put out in order to debunk the lies that have been told about him, it's just full of crap.
Well, apathy is never a good quality.
Well, and it's not even true, though.
Quality, yeah. But it's not even true. But apathy, I can understand apathy because, you know, there are people who aren't politically active, who aren't really politically developed, and they may not really know what's going on. They may just, you know, trust what the media says. And there are a lot of people like that. And, you know, I don't criticize people like that. But what Greenwald was doing was sitting on Twitter, holding court, haughtily calling people out for their support of the war, and then lying about his own support. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find really, really vulgar. And I think it's really strange that he would say things like, you know, Bush was the leader of my country. I felt loyalty to my country. I placed the benefit of the doubt in the Bush administration. You know, I had some concerns and some doubts, which seems odd. If he was apathetic, then why did he have concerns and doubts? But, you know, we can set that aside. But ultimately, he felt that Bush was entitled to have his national security judgment deferred to. And so my point is, you know, now that he's taken up drone war and the surveillance and the national security state as his mantle, he won't allow anybody else to have the feelings that he had at the time under Bush, when the people who may either be apathetic about drone strikes or who may find that there are other issues that concern them more about drone strikes, whether it's economic issues at home or racism at home or women's rights at home. You don't have the same sort of
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll address more of that, because it's interesting to me that he initially had the same feeling about the war that Britney Spears had. But and there was a lot of that going around. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
There are things we know, we also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
I'm never playing again as long as you live.
That was Donald Rumsfeld playing the hits.
That's right. Dedicated, going out to
some the things we know things and the we things know. We don't
All right.
know. And
do you know how annoying that statement was? And a lot of people made hay of it. And there was here's the thing about that statement. A, it's not new to Donald Rumsfeld. It is a philosophical musing that has been around forever.
Yeah.
And it applies to the Iraq War on the same level that it applies to you in traffic. There are things you know, things you know you don't know, things you don't know you know, and things you don't know you don't know. You know what a red light means, you know what to do there. So that's a known known. You know you don't know how the drivers on your left and right are going to react when they go. Who's going to go the fastest? Whether you should, you know, who you
right.
should pick. You know, so
that's
you don't
your
know.
Unknown.
No, you can judge, but you don't know. There are known unknowns. You know things that you don't. No.
You know what you don't know.
You know what you don't know. Then there are the unknown knowns, things you don't know that you know, like the statistic that most people don't cross the center line and kill you. You don't know that number, but you're aware that that's how you get to work.
How many listeners do you think we just lost?
No. we gained Donald Rumsfeld, and that's the important part, because he thinks he's important now. And there are things you don't know, which is you don't know that there's a cop that hasn't turned his siren on, driving perpendicular, he's going to strike the side of your car. You don't know that. So that piece of dialogue that he brought up on the news was intended to make him sound smart and strategic, when it is factually and annoyingly correct, no matter who says it, about anything.
Anything.
About sitting on the toilet. There are things you know, and things you know you don't know. There are things you don't know you know, and there are things you don't know you don't know. So
I don't even want to begin to fathom where that goes.
It's dumb. That is smokescreen language, and it is so irritating. Still on the line with us, by the way, is someone who never uses smokescreen language, the angry black lady herself, Imani Gandhi. By the way, angryblacklady.com is the site, and at angryblacklady is on the Twitter. And all the Glenn Greenwald fans can all send their, you know, their hate mail there, which is, by the way, just one person, Glenn himself. But there you go.
PA Planner 13 on Twitter, who often comments, says they'll welcome us with cheers and flowers.
Yeah, that was their favorite lie.
Yeah.
Their favorite Iraq lie. This is looking at, you know, Amani, looking at the news, do you see a similar strategy when it comes to Syria and those kind of things, or even other, even healthcare for that matter, or women's rights? There's this idea of, you know, the you know, creeping Sharia and the idea that workers' rights somehow lead to communism and that women's rights leads to, you know,
abortions
prophylactic abortions just because right. by lazy women who just want to make more money. P.S. They don't have any the ambitious women who have abortions just for business reasons so that they can keep their job or keep or go up the corporate ladder and not be moms. P.S. Women aren't as ambitious as men. That storyline
is that really an argument?
Well, yeah, that women have prophylactic abortions because they're not that they have it's a lifestyle choice abortion because they want to be. They want to have it all when they want to have it, and so they.
I thought it was irresponsible women who don't work who just use it as.
No, no, no. Those are the women who have the babies just so they can get more government money.
Ah, okay.
So they get food stamps. Yeah, no. There's definitely this, you know, this notion that you know we need to chip away at abortion rights because women are you know getting an abortion, squeezing it in between their mani-pedi appointment and their you know eyebrow wax.
Mm-hmm.
And I think generally in politics, there's always sort of this overarching attempt to dumb down the conversation to the lowest common denominator, or to talk about, especially when it comes to abortion rights, to talk about it in a way that forces people who have a particular viewpoint to move the rhetorical framework towards the opponent's argument.
Right.
For example, I don't know if you saw the Richard Dawkins tweet, this week that is pissed people off both left and right, where he talks about saying, where he says, you know, I'm pro-choice, but, you know, I think there's a certain point where considerations of fetal pain outweigh a woman's choice. And I sort of, another thing besides Greenwald ranting yesterday, I was ranting about that because I don't accept that framework because I don't think we live in a world where those types of abortions are the usual types of abortions.
Right.
And so what the anti-abortion folks are doing is trying to make pro-choice people look like monsters and feel bad by making them answer questions like, do you think there's any point in time at which a woman should not be able to terminate a pregnancy?
Mm-hmm.
And so they try and say, you know, with respect to later abortions, there should be a point at which a fetus definitely feels pain or a fetus is definitely more of a person than, you know, not. In which case, whatever choice the woman has must cede to concerns about the fetus.
Well, and then
we get to the point
where they want to, if we can only save one, we're going to save the kid.
Right, exactly. And the reality is those aren't the kinds of abortions
right.
that are occurring the most. And what happens when I think pro-choice activists accept that framework, when they're forced to say, well, yeah, you know, I do think at a certain point a woman should not be allowed to abort, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the world that we live in. And so I don't, my work as a women's rights activist and reading all of these bills and writing about the stuff for RH Reality Check is not to talk about the rare cases of abortion because those rare cases are usually involve some developmental disability or some developmental problems where the baby won't even live outside the womb. And moreover, you know, the anti-choicers don't really care about fetal pain either. They say that they do because it's a good argument for them because it makes pro-choice people look like monsters. But if they were so concerned about fetal pain, they would care about the pain or the life of the fetus once it exits the womb.
Right.
And they don't. And the fact that they don't, it makes it perfectly clear that it becomes more about reducing women's choices, chipping away at reproduction rights, and not about concern for life.
Right. Well,
about life, they wouldn't be, you know, gutting social safety nets. They would be more concerned about fair pay for women. They would make it easier for women to get contraception so that they don't have to have kids that they're not ready to take care of or that they don't want to take care of or whatever the case may be. So,
I had somebody call in on the Saturday show talking when the Violence Against Women Act passed. And he said, I don't understand why, you know, if, crime is a crime, violence is violence. Why don't women, you know, what's the difference? You know, if somebody's being assaulted, it's assault. Why do women need special consideration or special help? Why do they need a violence against, why don't we have a Violence Against Men Act? And that's kind of, and my main reason was because of all the other egregious ways women have, marks against them societally. Not the least of which is the fact that you make 70 cents on the dollar for the same amount of work. So if a woman is in a domestic violence situation, she lives at home, and she and her husband are barely scraping by, and they've got three kids, and he starts drinking and starts punching her out, she's got to think, not only when I leave this house, am I not going to have the same money he makes if I have to get a job to raise these kids because I got to take them with me. If he's the kind of guy who's punching me, he's certainly going to take it out on them. But I'm going to do it at 70% less. I've got to, that's a consideration that even if it's not an active one, is permanently there. And when you talk about things like equal pay for equal work or equality in the workplace or the ability for women to rise in a company, all that talk has to be factored into all the secondary choices that you're saying women have to make anyways. Mm-hmm. So a choice about whether to carry a pregnancy to term or even have a child or leave a violent relationship or any of those kind of things, have with it the baggage of, P.S., while you do that, you're going to make 70 cents on the dollar to what a man makes.
Right. Not only that, I think when you talk about reproductive rights and choices, I mean, ultimately it takes two people to make a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you've got two people now who've made a baby, whether it's wanted or unwanted, mm-hmm. right? And if you have to make a decision as to whether or not you're going to carry that to term or terminate that pregnancy, you know, ultimately, legally, the man has a right to weigh in on that decision, but it's your body, it's your physical strain, right? And so the woman at that point, there's a much larger vested interest in what physically is happening to you.
Well, even beyond that, when, you know, pre-Obamacare.
And financially, right. 90% of the time it does fall to the woman, unless you have some sort of arrangement or agreement or somebody calls and says.
I wouldn't say 90%. I wouldn't. But I would say.
Well, also, I mean, pregnancy is not a walk in the park. I mean, it's not what you see on soap operas where, you know, it's a glowing woman and everything's fine. And if
she sweats a little bit and then
the baby just pops out and it's fine. I mean, pregnancy is very, I mean, I've never been pregnant, but I have friends who are and have been pregnant, it's not a walk in the park. It's very hard on the body. And so to have, you know, men primarily making choices, making proclamations from a legal standpoint about what women are or are not allowed to do with their bodies is just disgusting. And moreover, this isn't an issue that affects, you know, predominantly white, predominantly wealthy women, because they will always have the best health care. They will always be able to, even if abortion were made illegal in this country, there will always be those women who will be able to afford to go to another country or to hire some,
or go,
you know,
visit their aunt upstate and come back unpregnant.
Right, exactly. So these policies that these legislators are putting into place affect women of color and low-income women the most. And those are the most vulnerable people in our society, and those are the ones who are the most voiceless, and those are the ones that are being affected, negatively affected by these policies. So it really bothers me when people try to force me to have, you know, an academic or a moralistic argument based on these rhetorical frameworks that just are not applicable in real life.
Well, and especially when you're dealing with, for example, pre-Obamacare, and when these are kicking in, A, that women's contraception is covered so that they don't have to shell out of pocket.
If you have health insurance, you don't have to pay extra money
to get your contraception. And on top of that, before this, being pregnant, having had a baby, is considered a pre-existing condition by a lot of insurance
companies.
Being
a woman of childbearing age
is
enough to make your premiums go up. Being a woman is a pre-existing condition.
Right, but what I'm saying is one of the reasons for that is because if you're planning on having a pregnancy, the cost, you know, medically, you're expected that you will have a child if you even say, yes, I plan in the future to have a kid. They're going to have to pay out, and they know that about you. But once you've had the child, and you've been through that period, there's no indication that you should have to pay for a disease you're somehow going to have simply because in the past you had a child. And that's really what they were doing. They were, you know, they're taking any woman who's had a child, that's considered a tumor as far as we're concerned that you had removed early on. Hello, Catholic Church, by the way. That whole rigmarole. We got to take a break, and I want to thank you, Imani Gandhi, for coming on with us, the Angry Black Lady.
Another amazing contribution to the show.
I know how to find them.
Some good chicks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I use that in the most endearing term because I like the phrase chick.
All right, good.
Well, thank you, and thank.
Yes. Thank you, Amani. AngryBlackLady.com.
Can I just jump in and say thank you for the sassy black lady fragrance idea? I think I might have to go with
Isn't
that
funny? It was totally true. I'm going to have to Google the exact name, but I think it was Sassy Black Woman.
I think you need an Angry Black Lady one, and go and the ad will have somebody walk up and go, "You smell pissed." We'll be back right after this.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What's all that noise?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. We're in the waning moments of this particular episode. We only have about 8 minutes of actual live time because we had a great conversation with Amani Gandhi. We also had a great conversation with Katie Speak yesterday.
They're great.
Yeah, Angry Black Lady, katiespeak.com, angryblacklady.com. Of course, Wendell Potter, who we spoke to earlier today. And tomorrow, we'll continue a little bit about the Iraq wars. I know we're not going to be able to get to all the lies today, but I want to get to,
sad is that? That there's so many.
There are totally. Let's go to Anthony in Las Vegas because he's been holding a long time. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for hanging in there.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about the fact that it's the media that the biggest lie that they pushed out was the fact that Iraq could truly threaten America, threaten our interest. And the point that I wanted to really make is I see those same drum beats going right now when it comes to Syria and Iran, and we have to not walk into the same mistake. And if we do, it's more millions of people that died, you know, and it's not just our American troops that died, you know. I mean, millions of people have died basically from the spark of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And we cannot continue to make the same mistakes over and over because, I mean, ultimately, I mean, I think attacking like Iran or Syria could lead into a world war possibly. I mean, are we going to make the same mistake and believe the media and say that Iran's going to nuke us and North Korea's going to nuke us and so forth like that? I mean, we really have to have an anti-war approach. I mean, it's the only way that's going to save lives, basically, if people are pro-life, I guess, in that level.
Well, I appreciate the call, and thanks for hanging on as long as you did. He brings such an excellent point to this, and it's the reason why I wanted to do this. More than it's just the anniversary, is that past being prologue, we can expect the exact same kind of mechanic coming into this kind of a situation. Whenever they want to get us into war, they're not going to reinvent the wheel to do it. Let's go to James in North Carolina. Hey, James.
Hey, fellas. Love the show. Real quick, I've got a line, two quick comments.
Okay.
My comments, let's not forget the media, how they curled up in the fetal position after 9/11 and were afraid to do their job.
I think it was also a fear of looking anti-patriotic, too.
That was part of the plan. You could make people look anti-patriotic just for asking real, normal questions.
That's not the media's job, look patriotic or not.
Exactly. You're totally right.
Yep.
And let's not forget that at the time, if I remember the percentages right, over 70% of the American people were dumb enough to believe Saddam had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite lie, quote unquote, got to be the aluminum tubes, man.
Right.
They showed them to a professor, I believe, I don't remember the man's name, he told them they weren't the right size, I believe.
Yeah.
But yet they see Colin Powell in front of the United Nations, and he sits there in front of the world and just tells a bald-faced, blatant lie.
Absolutely. They knew full well that those sites that they were showing had nothing to do with WMDs, had nothing to do with the nuclear program, had nothing to do with chemical weapons in any form, and they basically cattle-prodded him out in front of there and said, say this because we know other stuff we haven't told you yet, so if it blows up, it's on your head, basically. It was this weird form of blackmail, and he should have known better, and I know he regrets it because he's mentioned it since, but that's not enough. You got to be that guy, I think. You got to be that guy that walks away. I appreciate you bringing it up and hanging on as long as you did, James. Let's go to an international one. Here's Randy in Missouri.
Hi, guys. Great job this week.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Look at that.
I didn't have to listen to my In This Moment CD during the commercials. It's rocked on, Hal.
We do what we can.
By the way, when you're rocking, you look like that little boy in the E-Trade commercials. Anyway, and thanks to George for reminding us all to stay strong against this.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an international lie. I remember George Bush telling Tony Blair to help us out and stated that Atomic Energy Commission said that they were 6 months away from weapons of mass destruction. Well, the Atomic Energy Commission said that that was not the truth, and so a spokesman for the White House came on and said that Bush had made a mistake, that he meant 1991, not 2001, and the Atomic Energy Commission immediately came out and said that that is not the truth either. So now we've got Tony Blair involved, and
The Downing Street memo is one of those things where it was just you could not get a clear sign that they were fabricating the conversation specifically to manipulate the media and the public to believe what they were telling them so that they could do this because they didn't have the truth behind them. Really appreciate it. Let's go to – I want to try and get through as many of these as I can because we're stacked with calls. Let's go to Jim in Florida. Hey, Jim. Fire away.
Hi. Well, I am truly torn between two.
Okay.
One is whatever lie was told that has kept Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Condoleezza Rice from being tried as war criminals and being sent to prison. Whatever lie that was, that's where they need to be. And the other one is the general lie of if we don't do fill in the blank with your choice, then the terrorists have already won.
Yes, the terrorists will win. If you don't go shopping. Uniquely American. Go shopping.
Right.
Cuz if you don't go shopping, thank you so much.
Exactly. If you don't go shopping, yeah. the terrorists win.
Yeah. We got to celebrate Christmas in all its glory, or the Muslims will know that they've won.
Right.
So buy more extra plastic stuff from China. All right, thank you so much, Jim. We need more Chinese plastics to know
that
the terrorists.
That became a joke for so long. Like, and, if you don't do X, the terrorists win.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
It just became a
and
joke.
In North Carolina, it was used so that because it was used so much. And in North Carolina, go ahead. We've only got about a minute and a half left, so fire away. 30 seconds.
Fire away. Here I go. Mine was more of a visual. Remember Ari Fleischer standing in front of the banner that said Operation Iraqi Liberation?
Uh huh.
And then the White House. Realized or somebody realized in the White House circles, my gosh, that spells oil, and then it was changed to Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Right.
Yeah.
And then later on they admitted it was for oil, in which it sounds like, again, a wink. Let us not forget that the whole, and I appreciate the call for bringing that up specifically. Remember Jessica Lynch? Remember the girl who they rescued?
Yes.
Who turned out it was a total lie. It was a fabricated hero story they made up as if we need a reason to make our soldiers look heroic. They are. It happened on April 1st. It was a planned media event, and they put it on April 1st. You think the OIL was an accident? I don't think so. We'll see you tomorrow with more of the Stephanie Miller
Show.
Back? Yeah, we're back tomorrow.
We're back.
Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow.